Welcome to Jazz United, a podcast from WBGO. This is Greg Bryant, your host of Jazz After Hours.
And I'm Nate Chenin, the editorial director at WBGO.
We like to get together on here and chew the fat, if you will, and generally talk about just what's on our minds and different topics in our music community. Today, we want to talk about a great bassist, entrepreneur, even composer, William Parker.
Hero.
Yeah.
It is William Parker's season. Mm-hmm. How great is it that we get to say that? Early in 2021, there's a lot of things going on, and one of them is a happy convergence. The simultaneous release of a 10-CD box set and the first biography of William Parker. So we'll be talking about both of those things and a whole bunch more as we attempt. This is a futile attempt, but we're going to try anyway. We attempt to throw our arms around the magnitude that is the genius of William Parker.
Indeed, indeed. And Mr. Parker, if you're listening, thank you for your service. You've given us a lot to chew on over the years.
Yes, he has.
Man, the first thing I think about William Parker as bassist is his feel and his ability to feel. And that's something that you've been helping to remind us about, Nate, and I appreciate you for that. But again, 2020 into 2021, what is feel for you?
You know, I think increasingly I'm beginning to understand it as the ability of an artist to bring their whole self to the equation. It's a combination of your training, your instinct, the sum of your lived experience, really integrating and incorporating all of the things that make you who you are. And you're right. This is one of those things that William Parker has proven to be, you know, a true adept in this way. I mean, really, any recording that you cue up, you will hear the entirety of this man expressed through music.
Let's listen to Sound Unity. This is the William Parker Quartet here. Lewis Barnes, Rob Brown, and Hamid Drake along in the quartet. Title cut to Sound Unity, the William Parker Quartet.
So let's talk about this book because, there's so much detail in here, including a lot of stuff that for me is being illuminated for the first time. So the author is Cisco Bradley, and the book is called Universal Tonality, The Life and Music of William Parker. It's coming on Duke University Press in February. And I don't know, Greg, do you feel the same way? Like, was this helpful in your understanding of William Parker?
Very. Number one, I get excited when we hear and learn of new biographies written on not the usual suspects.
Right, right.
That's showing a healthy jazz system, if you ask me. But I feel like in general, the information about his early upbringing, in particular, how he began playing, was a real illumination, because it's not the typical story of this guy goes to music school and bursts on the scene. It's way more folky than that.
Yeah, folky is a good way to put it. And there's also some really nice family history that Bradley works in here. He talks about, he talks about, you know, the ancestral linkages to West Africa. Mm-hmm. He talks about the fact that that William Parker's parents actually met at the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem. You know, they were basically kids and they met at a dance. And so the first chapter of this book, which opens the section called Origins, it actually begins with a sentence that reads, William Parker was a child of the Harlem Renaissance, mm-hmm. which I thought was a cool summoning in a way, because mm-hmm. not only is that a reference to his parents, but, you know, I was really interested to see how much poetry there was right. in his early life. Right. So, you know, it's Duke Ellington, but it's also reading Harlem Renaissance poets and then hearing people like Amiri Baraka mm-hmm. and Joseph Jarman also, you know, like this understanding that the music and the writing and the art are really all entwined. You know, that's
exactly.
Yeah, that's a powerful thing to understand intuitively from such an early age.
True, true. And for a person of his generation, how much the new medium of television was really helping to awaken his consciousness. Specifically, mm-hmm. I'm speaking about there was a short run television show called Soul. It was serious. If you can find it and they're around, research those episodes, folks. You will see a smorgasbord of Black creative excellence all across the board. But for William Parker's case, it was his first chance to see Amiri Baraka. You know, it was mm-hmm. his first chance to be able to see several of the soul legends that he was hearing on the radio. And the energy of that helped to really awaken not a temporal consciousness, but something that was very deep and that would guide him through the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. You know, his concept of Blackness is not how he talked or how he dressed. It was the evolving episode of his past experiences and a freedom to go wherever he went. That was really powerful to learn about.
Yeah. And I think it really, you know, if you're familiar with the work of William Parker and you begin to think about these connections, a light bulb will go off, right? Mm-hmm. Because he has always been interdisciplinary, right? Right. He's always incorporated these various elements, you know, both stylistic and cultural, and then different mediums and different disciplines. Mm-hmm. I've always thought of that as something that did come out of the avant-garde tradition. But, you know, helpfully, the groundwork laid in this book helps me to understand that it's even, you know, it runs even deeper than that. It's really foundational for him. Mm-hmm. Speaking of foundation, Greg, you're a bass player. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about William Parker's identity on the instrument, because he has such a distinctive sound and you know, voice on the right. bass. Right. It's not the only instrument he plays, but obviously right. it's his core.
Yes.
And I wonder what thoughts you have about that part of him.
Well, Percy Heath called him Iron Fingers.
Ah, yes.
and to really zone in on that, talks about the strength in his hands. William Parker's, I think they said his first or second instrument, somebody picked it up, a fellow bassist, and said the action, that's the distance between the string and the neck, was so high. It took serious force to just press the notes down to make them come out. So again, when you're able to project with the mere strength of your hands, there's a sound that develops naturally, not through amplification, that can help to define who you are as an individual. The sound really is in William's hands. Mm-hmm. And another formative experience that this book talks about, William was, I think, maybe a year in as a professional musician, and he has the opportunity to hear Ron Carter, Jimmy Garrison, and Reggie Workman play the show, basically taking turns on a single bass. But William could hear the difference in each player's conception, and it was merely based on the sound that was coming out of their hands. So that lesson took hold in William, and he's got a distinctive sound that he's developed and worked on through just sheer mechanics of strength and prowess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've heard him project on his instrument in a way that, you know, you look around for the pickup and the sound system and you're mm-hmm. like, how is all of that sound coming
right.
out of this
right.
acoustic instrument just with this, you know, this man's fingers? Like that's an excellent point. I mean, and it is a voice to me, you know, mm-hmm. it's such a singing tone yeah. that he has.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a track on his new release, which I don't think we've named yet. So this box set, mm-hmm. Which is out this week, it's called Migration of Silence Into and Out of the Tone World. And we should note here that William Parker, like Henry Threadgill, he's one of those people who always comes up with great titles.
That's right.
But so this box, we'll talk more about it, but this is 10 CDs. And it's out on, through Centering Records and Alm Fidelity. And this is an extraordinary, statement by William Parker. But, you know, as we talk about, you know, first of all, his early influences, and then also his identity and sound on the bass, there's a track on this box that I think brings those two things into conversation. So this is from disc 5 on the box. And the disc is called Harlem Speaks. It features Faye Victor on vocals and Hamid Drake on drums and percussion. And the tune I want to cue up is called Harlem Dances.
Harlem dances all the time, speaks to me in rhythm and rhyme. Ghosts and spirits only I can see. Harlem lives inside of me. Ellington, Basie, James Brown, Aretha Franklin, and Ella Fitzgerald, and Dorothy Donegan and Shirley Scott. Them 88 would be tingling and jumping the church and would come to town. Mary Lou Williams was something else. Esther Jones, yeah.
That was Harlem Dances, William Parker music from this brand new box set, Migration of Silence Into and Out of the Tone World, a 10-disc set just out today, as a matter of fact. And as we talk about William Parker, and his progression as a musician on the scene, specifically in the 1970s, something really hip is happening called the loft scene. Necessity is the mother of invention. And these cats are getting together informally and making music on their own terms. Nate, tell me a little bit about that from your perspective. You know, why are these guys, you know, coming together, and how are they able to really get through to the public, despite not being in any of the major venues?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said it, Greg, necessity, right? This was an era of artistic self-determination, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that there were no other options, mm-hmm. you know? The 70s were a really tough period for New York City financially, economically. The artistic community really had to come up with creative solutions for itself. And it coincided with the, you know, the rise of a generation of artists who had been inspired by the revolutionary music of the 60s. And so you have improvisers who are collaborating with visual artists and choreographers and, you know, all kinds of different members of the downtown community. And their work is not well served by mm-hmm. you know, the club infrastructure or, you know, performing arts venues. And so a lot of musicians develop their own spaces, often, you know, in a sort of legal gray zone, you know, in places that were not really designed for that. You know, they were residences like Sam Rivers's Studio Rivby, mm-hmm. Which he operated with his wife, Beatrice. You know, Ali's Alley, operated by the great drummer, Rashid Ali. Mm-hmm. All of these spaces in what it's hard to, you know, I always sort of shake my head at this idea that there was a period when, you know, Tribeca and Soho, what, you know, when you could you could have a what basically is like a gallery space for little rent and make that a kind of you know, little artistic utopia. But that's what was happening, you know. And Parker was, he was right in there, you know, he fell in with what was happening on the Lower East Side and the East Village. And he was well primed, you know, because of the listening that he had done growing up in the Bronx. You know, it all made sense intuitively to him, you know, to connect with people like Archie Shepp and Milford Graves and Cecil Taylor, who became probably the most important early kind of endorsement of his career, you know?
Yes, he was. Indeed he was. And just thinking about, again, as a musician, William's progression, being able to play multiple times a day, often, you know, on these loft concerts, sometimes before audiences, sometimes just in rehearsal settings. You know, these guys were exchanging ideas as fast as they were coming, you know, to their minds and fingers. Having that experience, though, even in a dwindling avant scene of the 70s, playing with Cecil Taylor is a huge boost. Cecil is one of maybe a handful of guys that are working regularly. I think William is saying playing with Cecil and Don Cherry is the only real money he made in the 1970s and going into the early 80s. You know, it's hard to think about, you know, just survival. How are these guys actually eating? You know, these concerts aren't charging, you know, the patrons a lot of money. They're very accessible, but again, they still have rent to pay. They still have, you know, lights to pay. But they're playing the music exactly on their own terms. And there's something to be said for that.
You know, we've seen, a coming around to the loft scene in our historiographies, right? It was such an alternative culture that it was not properly acknowledged in many histories of this music.
That's right.
Certainly, if you pay attention to something like Ken Burns Jazz, which just celebrated its 20th anniversary, you know, the loft scene is mentioned and kind of almost patronizingly, like, you know, set off in the corner or at the kids' table or something. You know,
barely grazed.
And I remember in, I think it was the late 90s, the Knitting Factory label released a box set called Wildflowers, which was, you know, a compilation of recordings made, you know, in various spaces on the loft scene. That was really important. And then we've begun to see more writing and more scholarship on, you know, just what this whole underground creative ecology meant, you know, and it was really important and had repercussions that sometimes you really have to know where to look, right?
But
I think about someone like the great bassist Dave Holland, you know, who is about as like he's as much a part of the kind of establishment now as you can be as a jazz musician. He's one of the totemic figures, but you know, he was deep in the loft scene. He was very, very deeply involved, as a, you know, collaborator of Sam Rivers. And, you know, William Parker is another one of those figures. It so happens that he's become like his greatness and his stature have rumbled along an alternative path, you know? So I think of him and Dave Holland as like an interesting compare and contrast, right? Because they both have connections to this scene and they just took different paths. Some of those relationships that Parker formed, you know, I guess 40 years ago, 45 years ago now. Those are still some of the core relationships that he celebrates in his music, you know.
That's true.
And I know that one of those you've listened to closely, this band Ensemble Muntu, led by Janelle Moondock, was one of the early you know, sort of laboratories for Parker. And there's a cool quote in the book if you'll indulge me.
I know where you're going.
Jamil Mundock heard William play at Studio Rivbi. Mm-hmm. And here's what he said was his first impression. The first time I ever played with William, it was a truly amazing musical connection. Parker's sound is big, deep, and dark, and he has big ears. We play together with ease and freedom of movement. William can swing and drive. He can strut and dance on the bass. It was this incredible freedom. That's a, you know, that is as succinct and accurate an impression of his yeah. sound as you're going to get.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've seen the two of them together in various settings over the years, you know, and it's one of a handful, more than a handful, really, of connections that William has that are right. really special.
Right. Yeah. That whole band was on the level, so much so that between Parker and the drummer at the time, Rashid Baker, Cecil Taylor stole them from the field. So they were definitely cooking. But here might be a good time to play a little music with William and Jamil Mundock. This is actually Jamil Mundock's sextet from the early 80s, 1981. But it's got some of the amazing collaborators at the time. Khan Jamal on vibraphone, Roy Campbell on the trumpet, Dennis Charles on the drums. So this tune's called High Rise, Jamil Mundock featuring William Parker.
Was High Rise, the closing track from an early 80s album by the Jamil Mundock Sextet called Constanza's Delight. And Greg, I'll admit, I did not know this album. To my chagrin, thank you for hipping me to it.
Oh man, it's all good. We teach each other on this show, man. We hang, we have a good time, you know, and that's why, folks, we have to let you know we're a listener-supported effort. We appreciate your kind comments and emails that you give us, that you're enjoying the show. And we hope you do. And we hope that you'll take that next step to support us tangibly. You can give to our station, WBGO, securely online at WBGO.org/support. You can keep shows like Jazz United coming forth straight into your ears. And we appreciate you again for making it happen for us.
So as we talk about these relationships in William Parker's career, you know, some of the deepest and most inspiring for me were the ones that took place within and around the David S. Ware Quartet.
Yeah.
So this was a band that really had its heyday in the 1990s and early 2000s, and I saw them every opportunity I could. And it was always just one of those, it was always a night to remember whenever you saw this band. So this, it featured David S. Ware on saxophones, Matthew Shipp on piano, Parker on bass, and there was a succession of drummers.
Right.
And it, you know, in a cool way, the drum chair, it led to, you know, different sounds for this band in a certain way, but the core relationships there were always, you know, between Ware, Shipp, and Parker. And I don't know, I can think of a few bands that had a deeper mind meld than that one.
Absolutely, man. Again, quoting William, you know, he's talking about the best way to tribute your influences, not sound like them. You know, I think about David S. Ware and his direct proximity to Sonny Rollins. They were practice partners, I think, at it for a time. But I could think of no one more different than Sonny Rollins in their conception as David S. Ware, definitely with the power, but a different idea about how the saxophone should sound and how it should occupy a quartet setting. The same for William, you know?
You know, it's funny, Sonny's endorsement and his sort of enthusiasm for David S. Ware's music, mm-hmm. It reminds me of this moment. And I don't know, Greg, if you're hip to this, there was a minute in the late 90s when Columbia Records decided to make Branford Marsalis its A&R, its jazz A&R head, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the signature things that Branford did mm-hmm. was he signed the David S. Ware Quartet,
yes.
Which released a Columbia album called Go See the World. Mm-hmm. It was recorded in 97 and released in 1998. And to put it mildly, this is probably not what the suits at Columbia were expecting.
Hey, man, I don't know if the joke was on them, but it sure did work well for David S. Ware, because a lot of the cats that I was around, that was their first exposure to him. And it did a lot for that band's profile. I'll say that.
Yeah, and this was when the band included Susie Ibarra on drums,
mm-hmm.
and you know it really is one of my favorite albums by this band too. I feel like there's such a focus on it, by which I mean that the band sounds focused. You know? There have been various times when you know for one reason or another, music that you wouldn't expect on a major label manages to break through.
That's right.
And I'm thinking of that, you know, that period on Arista in the 70s, you know, when Anthony Braxton was recording for that label.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cecil was on major labels at various times,
mm-hmm.
Ornette Coleman. But this one, you know, especially in the context of the 90s, it was a jolt.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I've always wondered, I don't know if you have, but how much of that is just, you know, the proverbial, you know, throwing things against the wall to see what sticks versus actually doing the research to see this mm-hmm. might be a commercial success? I know neither one of us are record execs, but do you think about that much?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot, and especially back then, mm-hmm. there was a lot of throwing things at the wall to see what sticks because nobody really ever knows, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to use a recent example, if you had taken conventional record business logic and applied it to the idea of Kamasi Washington's first album,
okay.
Like really a triple album, you know, of these, like these songs that are all like 12 or 15 minutes long.
Sure.
Like that's going to be the biggest commercial success story of 2015, really. Mm-hmm. You know, in the case of David S. Ware, I think there was one thing that maybe entered the picture, which was a lot of the sort of underground alternative and indie rock of that era, you know, was peopled by the likes of Thurston Moore and, you know, musicians who really revered, say, the Sun Ra Orchestra,
right?
And you know, and they really liked avant-garde jazz for, you know, for its intensity and its conviction and its transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a band like Yola Tengo, like talked to the members of that band, and they probably would have sung the praises of David S. Ware at that time.
So
there was that, you know, but. Suffice it to say that this album was not a commercial, you know, success story mm-hmm. for Columbia Records,
right.
But it certainly was a success story for the members of the band and for the music. You know, it received quite a bit of attention from people like me, you know, in the critical realm,
mm-hmm.
And it was a good look. You know, I, on the second album that they released on Columbia, which is called Surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
This to me was very telling. They actually cover a Charles Lloyd tune, Sweet Georgia Bright.
Yeah.
And to me, that was like a little wink and a nod, you know, like we are inhabiting that zone today. You know?
Yeah.
And that's a connection that I've made you know, with Kamasi, like, you know, that Kamasi occupies that zone. That sort of what Charles Lloyd was to 1968, Kamasi mm-hmm. Washington was to the late 2010s. Yeah. But yeah, there was something there, clearly. And, you know, much credit to Branford for making that decision the way he did.
Stepping out. Yeah, he really did. He really did. And it's really interesting just to see the community rally around the release. And then, you know, the late 90s, we're talking about, you know, something else is happening with William and the members of this community. They're putting on their own festival, the Vision Festival. There had been a couple of attempts in the 80s that were successful, but it really took hold around, I think, 96, 97. Again, this pandemic is a real drag, because that was another one of those things mm-hmm. that I definitely moved up here with the intention to be part of. Man, just set the scene for me, man. When you first got to the city, I know that was something that you went for.
Yeah. Well, so I arrived in New York in 1998. Mm-hmm. And so the 1999 Vision Festival would have been my first one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have rarely missed one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always an incredible expression of community and creativity. And we should say that William is a co-founder of the festival, but really the person who makes it happen is his wife, the right. dancer and choreographer, Patricia Nicholson Parker. Yeah. And, you know, they established the Arts for Art nonprofit. There's, you know, there's a board of directors. It's, you know, it's a really valiant organization that has, you know, since you mentioned the pandemic, I feel like we should note that they've managed to put on some concerts,
right?
And they've done their share of live streaming. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like everyone else, they're trying to keep it moving. Mm-hmm. But the Vision Festival, really, I think intuitively, I always understood this, but I've come to understand it more and more. It is a sort of living manifestation of the kinds of connections that William Parker has made throughout his entire career. Mm-hmm. They're sort of embodied by what goes down at the Vision Festival, you know, because it's not, you know, you can say that the Vision Festival has a kind of aesthetic center, which is like, you know, the free improvising, jazz avant-garde, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. But there's really room for all different kinds of stuff, from, you know, atonal to electronic music to, you know, to stuff that is much more quote unquote inside than you would expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've heard it all. I've heard it all at the Vision Festival. You know, including some really historic moments, like, mm-hmm. The year that Henry Grimes, you know, made his triumphant return playing an instrument that William Parker gave him.
Wow.
You know, a bass that had been stained olive green that Parker named Olive Oil, you know. Yeah. And where had Henry Grimes been, you know? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden it was a major thing, and it was the Vision Festival where he made that return. Mm-hmm. You know, just so many moments like that really add up to a kind of a sort of history in and of itself. You know, the Vision Festival really amounts to that.
Exactly.
So you haven't been to one yet?
I have not. But one of those things that William says, you know, how do you play music for people who aren't in the audience? You play it anyway with the positive intention that your playing is going to affect their vibrations. Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing these recordings, you know, and I'm seeing these photographs actually in the early 2000s from a mutual friend of ours, John Rogers, mm-hmm. who used to really go in and photograph these guys. And I'm seeing just the intense expressions on their faces. And it's almost like I can hear what the music is sounding like. And then getting the records, putting, you know, together who's who, I had a very good representation of some of the energy that you guys were experiencing, so much so that I want to be there in person, man. And I'll get there eventually.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that, that I think you'll appreciate when we're able to have a Vision Festival in person again, mm-hmm. and when you make that, that pilgrimage, mm-hmm. It feels different from any other gathering that I've experienced in this improvised music realm. Mm-hmm. You know, it really does. And you know, to give you one example, I looked up some of the reviews that I've written of Vision Festivals past, okay. and I was reminded when I saw my review from 2006, which was the 11th annual edition. This was at the Angel Orensanz Center on the Lower East Side, and that year, you know, as you walked around the space, there was a snack bar, and they were serving William Parker's fried chicken, you know, which he had literally made. You know, and it was it felt like a church potluck kind of vibe, yeah. You know,
uh-huh.
There's always that community spirit, like that real sense of like, mm-hmm. when you're there, you are welcomed in, mm-hmm. To this thing that like, you know, they'd be doing their thing with or without you. But once you're there, you're a part of it, you know?
Yeah. That's really cool to have that personal touch, you know, it mm-hmm. kind of, helps me to, put together William's beginning, you know, to where he is now, you know, starting out in Harlem at the Jazzmobile, getting some great instruction. But when he wants to bring up the music that he's really into, the avant-garde, no, we don't teach that here. We don't do that here. Mm-hmm. And instead of, you know, being that limited perspective for the music, you know, he wants to involve you. And from cooking the chicken to, yeah. you know, hosting in alternative spaces, man, that's cool.
And we should say too, that the Vision Festival is a place where dance and painting and poetry, mm-hmm. you know, it's all a part of the picture. There's really no distinction drawn between these various disciplines, you know, and politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in there. You know, I mentioned that 2006 review, and this is funny. I closed that review by talking about a trio that ended that the festival that year. And this band was called By Any Means, and it featured Charles Gale on alto saxophone,
wow.
Rashid Ali on drums, and William Parker on bass.
Oh my God.
And here's what I said. To an unexpectedly overwhelming degree, the driving force was Mr. Parker, whose bass lines conveyed an elemental and exuberant authority. Fittingly for the Vision Festival, he suggested an anchor in a raging sea. And it's funny, when I look at that again now, I think, oh yeah, of course that would be the case. But
yeah.
you know, when you're in a band with Charles Gale and Rashid Ali, and you are just taking it over, that says something about the sheer power, the sheer magnetic authority that he has. I feel like we need to hear some music now.
Come on with it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you know, instead of playing, instead of queuing up Charles Gale and Rashid Ali, although I would urge people to check out mm-hmm. those conferences, in a podcast dedicated to William Parker, it would be criminal not to include some music by Little Huey, mm-hmm. one of his flagship bands. So this is the Little Huey Creative Music Orchestra, which has released a handful of albums. This one's from an album called Mayor of Punkville, which was recorded at Tonic in 1999. And we, you know, we mentioned Parker's great titles. This is one of those. It's called James Baldwin to the Rescue.
Again, that's William Parker with the Little Huey Creative Music Orchestra. That tune was James Baldwin to the Rescue, recorded live at Tonic. Man, there is a lot of music in this new set, this new 10-disc yeah. set.
Well, you know, we often talk these days about the MCU, you know, the Marvel Creative Universe.
Yeah.
let's, you know, if we talked about the PCU, the Parker Creative Universe,
yeah.
you could jump in and never leave. I actually have a book called The William Parker Sessionography.
Oh, wow.
And it is, you know, it chronicles every gig or recording session that William has played on from 1972 up through June of 2014.
Man.
And this book is almost 500 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, it's completely out of date. You know, because it stops in 2014. And, you know, you think about, like, well, there's been, you know, more than 5 years since then. And that's a lot of gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just a reminder of, like, this man never stops. His creativity flows in so many different directions.
Yeah.
And you're right. This new box is a great reminder of that, but it's also, I think, a surprising one. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, there's something,
yeah.
Like, I really thought I knew William Parker and his sound world,
mm-hmm.
after seeing him live for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
This set actually surprised me.
Mm-hmm. Well, me too. For the sheer fact of the diversity of his output. I mean, he's really showing the modern blueprint of what it means to not only survive, as he says, but to thrive. He's got 10 different looks, 10 different options that he can give you. So if you're a festival promoter, oh, well, I tried that project last year. What about a new project this year? William's got you. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of venues, unfortunately, close their doors due to the pandemic. Well, William knows how to be a part of an independent music scene that has venues to present the style of music as well as the audience. That's a plus. He has been well promoted, not only in the press, but among his peers. I think William Parker, by being shut out so many years and having to make this new infrastructure, is really the leader of the pack when we come out of this pandemic thing. Because you're going to have to do what? Record yourself, release yourself, promote yourself, and present yourself. William does all those things.
Yeah. And you mentioned these 10 different looks. I mean, it's worth acknowledging just how different they are.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're the creative community that is represented here is that part of it is not a surprise, right? Because right. These are people that have been in this orbit for some time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a CD here called Afternoon Poem that features Lisa Sokolov on mm-hmm. vocals. There's one called Lights in the Rain that features Andrea Wolper
yeah.
on vocals. You know, there's an, you know, we've already heard some of the Harlem Speaks album with Faye Victor.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that features Kyoko Kitamura. There's a lot of vocalists mm-hmm. here, you know. And they all bring different identities, different, you know, sonic dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And they all sound great with William Parker's music. The album called Mexico, is really powerful. Has Jean-Carla Rodea on vocals with an ensemble that includes, Brahim Fribgane on oud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jackson Crawl on percussion and, you know, a handful of other people, including trumpeter Matt Lavelle.
Mm-hmm.
And we should say, too, that William plays, you know, he doesn't just play bass. He plays, you know, a bunch of other stringed instruments. He plays, you know, some flutes,
mm-hmm.
plays hand percussion. You know, it really is like an incredibly broad and varied thing. And in light of all that, you get the sense that even this is just beginning to scratch the surface.
It's really amazing at this spot in his career to see not only the audience for William's music at a maximum height, but to hear him play at his maximum abilities and thrust. There is an equilibrium. There's a consistency across all of these discs. Mm-hmm. That all of these programs have different colors, but the quality is still there. And that may be ambitious for someone who's only been in the game for, you know, 2 or 3 years to do something like this. But William has earned this right. He has been on the battlefield, proverbial battlefield. And it's awesome just to see him winning new listeners through music that's just as strong and as breathtaking and as adventurous as he's ever been.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this phrase that Amiri Baraka introduced to the lexicon famously in his book, Black Music, the changing same.
Mm-hmm.
And when he formulated that, Baraka was talking about the connections that are there to be made between spirit music, between, you know, what was then being called the new music.
Yeah.
And something like, you know, James Brown, you know, like soul and R&B and avant-garde jazz, and how it all came from a common root and had similar things to impart. And William Parker may be one of the most logical proponents of that idea today. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't mentioned his affinities with Curtis Mayfield.
Oh, man.
But, you know, I saw him present that project at the Vision Festival. And what's remarkable about those moments when William goes, quote unquote, inside,
mm-hmm.
Is how unremarkable it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like he has such a deep groove, and it's so clear that he is that he loves that music, soul music, and, you know, Ellington and yep. Mingus and, you know, all of this stuff that you think about being more to the center mainstream of the jazz tradition. You know, his relationship with that is deep and unforced, and it's beautiful, you know.
Yeah.
As it is with someone like Mayfield,
yeah,
someone like Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think we're coming, we, by which I mean the whole scene,
uh-huh.
have been coming around to that understanding for some time.
Exactly. Exactly.
William has already been there for a long time, but some of us are just now coming around to that idea.
He's pointing the way, man. It's a continuum. It's a continuum. And that may be a chat for another episode, but this Black American music thing is a really beautiful, a beautiful language. And thanks to William, we're getting a chance to experience that in just a really distinct voice.
Yeah. I think by way of illustration, you know, we were talking about how there's really no way to play a representative clip from this box.
Right.
There's too many entry points.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we go out with something from disc 2, which is a solo piano recital by featuring Eri Yamamoto. And so this is, you know, piano music by William Parker. If you heard it without any context, you know, I don't know that you would necessarily know that he was the composer.
Right.
But then the more time you spend with it, I think you can hear his, you know, his sonic identity. And so this is a track called Mexico, which is also the title track of a later album, the one with Giancarlo Rodea. So this is a, you know, sort of a motif that pops up more than once on this box.
Yeah.
But I just think Eri Yamamoto's playing on it is so beautiful. So yeah, let's hear that as we go out.
Jazz United is a production of WBGO and is hosted by me, Greg Bryant, and by Nate Chenin. Our producer is Sarah Kirsten. Our senior producer is Simon Rentner. Right now, you're hearing Mexico, written by William Parker, performed by Ira Yamamoto. Our theme music at the top of the show is United by Wayne Shorter, performed by trumpeter Woody Shaw. Rate us, like us, subscribe to us on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Also on WBGO.org.